was made when he was in the mood for a sweep, meaning a whole-scale removal of Federalists to make room for loyal Republicans. On other occasions, he adopted a more conciliatory line, claiming he would leave Federalists in most government jobs and replace them only as vacancies arose. At times, he sounded an even more benevolent note, suggesting that rank-and-file Federalists should be appointed and only the most die-hard Federalist leaders, whom I abandon as incurables, should be excluded. If we can hit on the true line of conduct, he wrote to Horatio Gates, which may conciliate the honest part of those who were called Federalists and do justice to those who have so long been excluded from it, I shall hope to be able to obliterate, or rather unite, the names of Federalists and Republicans. This sounded like the most generous reading of the "We are all Republicans, we are all Federalists" line in his inaugural address. For several months, he oscillated back and forth among these different positions. Jefferson's patronage dilemma grew out of the unprecedented political situation created by his election. He was the first leader of an opposition party elected to the presidency, and the first recognized party leader to face the loaves and fishes problem with all the middle and lower level federal offices still occupied by the outgoing administration. In subsequent years, it became common practice and a matter of mutual understanding that victory in a presidential election meant a wholesale changing of the guard along party lines. Nothing terribly principled or massively moral was at stake. Patronage was a simple byproduct of political power, but the victorious Republican Party had come to power believing in its own virtue and claiming to represent a restoration of principles that dispensed with politics as usual. As Henry Adams put it, such a state of things could never occur again, for only a new country could be inexperienced in politics. It was awkward for Jefferson to start behaving like a party leader after a decade of denying that the Republicans were a political party at all. The practical resolution of this dilemma is less significant per se than for what it revealed about Jefferson's inherently moralistic mentality. Throughout the 1790s, he had described the Federalists as an evil faction of crypto-monarchists and closet Tories who had commandeered the original purpose of the American Revolution and carried the government to the brink of irreversible corruption. This highly charged diagnosis had never been factually accurate. Very few of the Federalists were outright monarchists. Indeed, if one were searching for such creatures, the top candidate would have been Burr, who was a Republican and Jefferson's vice president to boot. The underlying issues separating Federalists and Republicans were not really moral so much as constitutional and strategic. The Federalists preferred a more consolidated federal government in which more power was allocated to the executive and judicial branches, and America's primary European ally and role model was England. The Republicans wanted a smaller and weaker federal government, in which the House of Representatives was the dominant force. They looked to France as our chief European friend. While these were hardly incidental differences, they had their origins in fundamentally juxtaposed ideas about the proper allocation of political power in a Republican government, they did not really translate into the kind of moral imperatives that Jefferson's mind required to mobilize its political energies. Yet for Jefferson to mean what so many readers of his inaugural address thought he meant, that the differences between Federalists and Republicans were imminently negotiable, would have required him to acknowledge that his moral crusade of the 1790s had been misguided. By the summer of 1801, Jefferson had reached his conclusion. There were Federalists and there were Federalists. The former were unredeemable monarchists, incurable monocrats, and the desperados of the quondam faction. He claimed to wish nothing but their eternal hatred, and if that were to cease, I should become suspicious to myself. The latter were misguided followers who preferred a somewhat stronger executive, but in their heart of hearts were really Republicans and therefore entitled to the confidence of their fellow citizens. The beauty of this simplistic distinction was that it allowed Jefferson to retain his moral categories, indeed to focus his hatred even more intently on the surviving pockets of recalcitrant Federalist influence, especially in New England, while simultaneously adopting a conciliatory posture elsewhere and encouraging mass defections to the Republican Party. In Connecticut, for example, he claimed that most citizens remained mesmerized by the vilest version of the Federalist persuasion. Their steady habits exclude the advances of information, and they seem exactly where they were when they separated from the saints of Oliver Cromwell. They were, he believed, willing to follow the bark of liberty only by the help of a tow rope. Connecticut therefore demanded a general sweep of Federalists from office. Appointing a Federalist there was like appointing an atheist to the priesthood. Massachusetts was only slightly better, though Jefferson held out the hope that, as the Indian says, they are clearing the dust out of their eyes there also, so that eventually the Republican portion will at length arise, and the sediment of monarchism will be left as lees at the bottom. Until then, however, a clean sweep was necessary in Massachusetts, too. Jefferson's moral distinctions were lost on most Federalists, who regarded the mass removals in New England as a betrayal of his inaugural promise. The truth is, noted the editors of the New York Evening Post, it has become ridiculous in Mr. Jefferson and his supporters to pretend that, in the present system of hunting the Federalists like wild beasts, they are governed by any principle or principles which will bear avowal or can be for a moment supported under any pretense whatsoever. The real truth was that pretense was very important to the Republicans. They did not want to think of themselves as typical politicians who traded their principles for raw power upon entering office. As for Jefferson himself, the messy matter of patronage exposed how his mind was capable of moving on parallel tracks. One side fiercely vindictive and merciless, the other accommodating and charitable. It all depended on where one landed in the inherently moral world that was Jefferson country. The patronage episode also revealed how alien Jefferson was to the pluralistic ethos so central to modern-day political liberalism, which accords respect to fundamentally different values and defines integrity as a civil, if spirited, dialogue among opposing ideas. His was the more traditional and universalistic conviction. There was one truth, not many. He could be endlessly patient and pragmatic about minor differences, but once it was clear your views lay on the other side of the line, it was war to the death. What saved the bulk of the Federalists, it turned out, was not generosity of spirit, so much as the fervent hope that they were really latent Republicans primed for conversion. It was a characteristically Jeffersonian outlook, and it contributed to his paradoxical reputation as an extremely cool and serenely civil man of considerable grace, who periodically unleashed sudden torrents of anger and hostility at his enemies. At the private level, it gave his otherwise smooth and soft demeanor a dangerous edge, especially for those who mistook his reticent style for indifference and blundered into one of the deeply felt subjects. At the semi-public level, such as cabinet meetings or one-on-one sessions in the presidential office, it enhanced his authority by suggesting a subterranean region forever concealed from view and inhabited by fearful forces that, if inadvertently unlocked, would take no prisoners. At the public level, the New England Federalists triggered the moral explosions, much as George III and then the Hamiltonians had done in previous years. But the most dramatic display of this Jeffersonian syndrome during his presidency, which also had the greatest consequence on domestic policy and subsequent American history, occurred in his treatment of Native Americans. Jefferson's attitude toward the Indian population of the United States has always seemed as profoundly paradoxical as his attitude toward slavery. On the one hand, he devoted an entire chapter in his Notes on Virginia to a celebration of the indigenous culture of America's original inhabitants, recalling the impressive oratorical skills of tribal chiefs, recommending the serious study of the different Indian languages and dialects, even going so far as to contrast Indians favorably with blacks, in terms of their mental and physical aptitude and their capacity for assimilation into white American society. As president, he greeted visiting Indian delegations with becoming graciousness and visible respect. On several occasions, he went out of his way to describe the Indian people of North America as a noble race who were the innocent victims of history. Endowed with the faculties and rights of men, breathing an ardent love of liberty and independence, as he so eloquently put it, and occupying a country which left them no desire but to be undisturbed, they have been overwhelmed by the current or driven before it. One senses in so many of Jefferson's observations on Indians an authentic admiration mingled with a truly poignant sense of tragedy about their fate as a people. On the other hand, it was during Jefferson's presidency that the basic decisions were made that required the deportation of massive segments of the Indian population to land west of the Mississippi. In the language of the leading scholar on the subject, the seeds of extinction for Native American culture were sown under Jefferson. The essence of Jefferson's thinking about Indian removal was expressed in a letter to the territorial governor of Ohio in 1803. In this way, our settlements will gradually circumscribe and approach the Indians, and they will in time either incorporate with us as citizens of the United States or remove beyond the Mississippi. The former is certainly the termination of their history most happy for themselves, but in the whole course of this, it is essential to cultivate their love. As to their fear, we presume that our strength and their weakness is now so visible that they must see we have only to shut our hand to crush them, and that all our liberalities to them proceed from motives of pure humanity only. This is a striking statement in several senses. Its casual sense of assurance about what history intended, its eerie mixture of charity and cruelty, its presumptive and paternalistic tone. In Jefferson's mind, the Indians occupied the same problematic space as the Federalists. They were a doomed species. Their dooming had not been his doing, but he had no compunctions or doubts about serving as the instrument of their destruction. And just as the rank-and-file Federalists should recognize that their political survival depended on embracing the central tenets of republicanism, as defined by the Republican Party, so the Indians should recognize that their cultural survival depended upon abandoning their nomadic hunting societies. These required too much land, and adopting an agricultural way of life, eventually the English language, and gradually assimilating into white American society. In short, Indian culture could survive by ceasing to be Indian, just as the Federalists could survive by ceasing to be Federalists. Those Indians who resisted assimilation, again like the recalcitrant Federalist leaders in Connecticut and Massachusetts, deserved nothing less than extermination or banishment. Like the Federalist ideologies in New England, Indian leaders who clung tenaciously to tribal mores and insisted on inculcating a sanctimonious reverence for the custom of their ancestors must be shown no mercy. Jefferson believed that banishment to the currently unoccupied lands west of the Mississippi was only a temporary solution, since the white migration would eventually overflow these lands too and pose the same question at a later date. But he was not burdened by any doubts about what constituted the right answer. When James Monroe, in his capacity as Virginia's governor, wrote him to raise the possibility of creating a Western Reserve for emancipated slaves, Jefferson opposed the idea on grounds that boded ill for Indians as well as blacks. It is impossible not to look forward to distant times when our rapid multiplication will cover the whole northern, if not southern, continent with a people speaking the same language, governed in similar forms and by similar laws, nor can we contemplate with satisfaction either blot or mixture on that surface. Just as he found it impossible to imagine a pluralistic American politics in which competing convictions about the meaning of the American Revolution coexisted, he had no place in his imagination for an American society of diverse cultures in which Native Americans lived alongside whites while retaining their own Indian values. Western Magic. There was also a sharp line running through Jefferson's constitutional thinking between foreign and domestic policy. Actually, to speak of constitutional thinking is a bit misleading, since Jefferson's mind preferred broader moral categories that hovered over the more conventional constitutional distinctions. In his own Jeffersonian way, however, he believed that the House of Representatives had primary responsibility for domestic policy, and the executive had equivalent responsibility over foreign affairs, though he seemed to have embraced a somewhat fuzzy caveat during the debate over the Jay Treaty that gave the House veto power over foreign treaties. At any rate, it would be fair to say that Jefferson did not think that the office of president should be as inconspicuous or invisible to foreign nations as it should to American citizens. Only 2 months after his inauguration, the Barbary pirates on the North African coast put this theory to the test when the Pasha of Tripoli declared war on the United States. The Pasha was incensed upon learning that the tribute he was receiving from the Americans was less than that which was being paid to Algiers. This was one old story to Jefferson, who had argued unsuccessfully with Adams in their Paris years that paying bribes to these seafaring terrorists of the Muslim world was dishonorable. Now, as president, he was in a position to implement his long-standing preference for military action. "I am an enemy to all these douceurs, tributes, and humiliations," he explained to Madison, and, "I know that nothing will stop the eternal increase from these pirates but the presence of an armed force." Fortunately, and with an irony that only Adams could have fully appreciated, the buildup of the American Navy that Adams had insisted on during his presidency, despite the opposition of Jefferson and the Republicans, meant that a fleet of frigates was available for Jefferson to dispatch to the Mediterranean. With the consent of his cabinet, only Gallatin, whose job was to worry about the budget, objected on cost grounds, Jefferson ordered a naval squadron to patrol the North African coast. Throughout his first term, then, and well into his second, the United States was engaged in a small-scale naval war in the Mediterranean that never achieved the decisive conclusion that Jefferson wanted. He revived his old scheme of creating an international task force comprised of European and American warships to police the region, perhaps a forerunner of the United Nations peacekeeping force, but it never materialized. At least at the symbolic level, however, the ongoing conflict with the Barbary pirates became America's first splendid little war, by generating patriotic rallies throughout the country. These reached a crescendo in 1804, when Stephen Decatur, an American naval officer, brazenly sailed into the Bay of Tripoli to rescue American prisoners of war on board the captured Philadelphia, and then proceeded to revenge his brother's death by killing his Muslim murderers in hand-to-hand combat. No less an authority than Lord Nelson of the British Admiralty called it the most bold and daring act of the age. Decatur's exploits were memorialized in verse and dramatic productions as the North African version of Bunker Hill. He became America's first 19th-century military hero. The Jefferson administration benefited from this nationalistic surge, though Jefferson was careful to remind all concerned that the naval operation in the Mediterranean was a mere sideshow and would not deter his plans to dry dock a hefty portion of the American fleet. In the grand scheme of things, the centerpiece of his foreign policy remained the avoidance of war at almost any cost. Retiring the debt and sustaining Republican austerity had to take precedence. In that sense, the campaign against the Barbary pirates was perfect. It was a safe and limited projection of American power abroad. It displayed Jefferson's resolve as president. It produced convenient heroes to celebrate, and it cost very little. It was, if you will, the ideal miniature war for Jefferson's minimalist presidency. There was nothing miniature about the American West. Nothing less than grandiose about Jefferson's vision of its future role in American history, and nothing but extraordinary presidential leadership matched with even more extraordinary good fortune that produced the Louisiana Purchase. When word reached Washington in 1803, on July 4th no less, that France had agreed to the sale of the Louisiana Territory for $15 million, the American Republic doubled in size overnight. Even compared with the legendary purchase of Manhattan from the Indians for a pittance, the acquisition of half a continent for about 3 cents an acre was a bigger steal. It was unquestionably the greatest achievement of the Jefferson presidency, and with room left for scholarly quibbling about Abraham Lincoln in 1861, Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s and Harry Truman in 1945, one of the most consequential executive actions in all of American history. It was fashionable for many years to tell the story of the transaction primarily as a meditation on the influence of dumb luck. Napoleon threw the province, so to speak, at Livingston, Monroe, Madison, and Jefferson, wrote one historian, and they share between them equally whatever credit there was in catching it and holding it, that is all. This interpretation represented a continuation of Federalist explanations at the time. The acquisition has been solely owing to a fortuitous concurrence of unforeseen and unexpected circumstances, said an editor in the New York Evening Post, and not to any wise or vigorous measures on the part of the American government. The fairer judgment would seem to be that Jefferson was both more fortunate and more prescient than anyone realized at the time, and his nearly mystical sense of the American West made him more flexible in the implementation of his political principles than at any other time in his public life. To seize an empire, it turned out, required an imperial president. Although he himself had never been west of the Shenandoah Valley, Jefferson's proprietary attitude toward the Mississippi Valley and beyond was long-standing. In the 1780s, when rumors spread that John Jay was negotiating the surrender of American navigation rights on the Mississippi to Spain, both Jefferson and Madison expressed outrage. They consistently described the Mississippi as the major artery of the American body politic. The Hudson, the Delaware, the Potomac, and all the navigable rivers of the Atlantic formed into one stream. While Secretary of State, most pointedly during the Nootka Sound crisis of 1790, Jefferson had been prepared to risk war in order to prevent either England or France from displacing Spain as the European presence in the trans-Mississippi West. From that time forward, Jefferson regarded Spanish ownership of the vast western region of North America as essentially a temporary occupation that conveniently bided time for the inevitable American sweep across the continent. Of all the European powers, Spain, the chronically weak, sick man of Europe, was, as Rufus King put it, the most proper to possess a great empire with insignificance. When rumors reached Washington in 1802 that Spain had ceded its rights in North America, including the all-important control over the Mississippi, to Napoleon and France, Jefferson immediately recognized the French presence as a fundamental shift in the strategic situation. It both threatened American security and blocked westward American expansion. Without quite shouldering Madison to the sidelines, Jefferson assumed personal control over the diplomatic initiative to remove this unacceptable intrusion of a major European power onto the American continent. His instructions to Robert Livingston, the newly appointed American ambassador to France, minced no words. He apologized for temporarily displacing the Secretary of State, but explained that he cannot forbear recurring to it personally, so deep is the impression it makes in my mind. The sale of the Louisiana region to France was a major disaster that completely reverses all the political relations of the United States and will form a new epoch in our political course. It constituted, he believed, the greatest challenge to American independence and national integrity since the American Revolution. There is on the globe one single spot, the possessor of which is our natural and habitual enemy, he explained to Livingston. That epicenter of American national interest was New Orleans. Despite past friendship with France and despite his own personal affinity for the Franco-American alliance, the moment France occupied New Orleans, the two nations must become mortal enemies. From that moment, he concluded ominously, we must marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation. Given his deep and lifelong hatred of England, Jefferson was effectively describing French control of the Mississippi as the equivalent of an international earthquake that moved all the geological templates into a new pattern. Though eminently capable, Livingston possessed the singular disadvantage of not being a Virginian. Jefferson wanted someone on the ground in Paris whom he could trust implicitly. So he, in effect, ordered James Monroe, a Jefferson protege currently serving as governor of Virginia, to become a special envoy to France. "The circumstances are such as to render it impossible to decline," Jefferson observed dramatically, "because, on the event of this mission, depends the future destinies of this republic." Monroe's instructions authorized the purchase of New Orleans and as much of the Mississippi Valley as possible. The geographic boundaries of the French acquisition from Spain were fuzzy, for up to $10 million. Even the paramount domestic goal of debt reduction was subordinated to recovering control over America's interior. During the winter and spring of 1803, while the outcome of the Monroe mission remained up in the air, Jefferson's management of the prospective crisis was deft and shrewd. He saw to it that Dupont de Nemours, an old French friend, was provided information about America's deadly serious intentions that could be leaked in the proper corridors at Versailles. When the Spanish official still governing New Orleans abruptly closed the port to American commerce, Jefferson came under considerable pressure to launch a unilateral military expedition to seize both the city and the Floridas, thereby abandoning diplomacy in favor of war with both Spain and France. Hamilton, writing as Pericles, endorsed the military solution, arguing that, "In an emergency like the present, energy is wisdom." Despite an authorization from Congress empowering the president to raise 80,000 volunteers for a military campaign, Jefferson remained calm. "Even if the ongoing negotiations in Paris failed," he explained, and of course they did not, "outright war was both unwise and unnecessary. Time and demography were on the American side, justifying a patient policy till we have planted such a population on the Mississippi as will be able to do their own business without the necessity of marching men from the shores of the Atlantic 1,500 or 2,000 miles thither." Jefferson was also extremely fortunate in some ways, ironically so. Napoleon's decision to sell not just New Orleans but also the entire Mississippi Valley and modern-day American Midwest was prompted by the resumption of the Anglo-French War in 1802. Ambassador Livingston had earlier complained that negotiating with France was impossible. "There is no people, no legislature, no counselors. One man is everything. He seldom asks advice and never hears it unasked." This, of course, was the essence of the Napoleonic all-or-nothing style. But once Napoleon decided to cut his losses in America, in return for money that would subsidize his European army, the same style worked to Jefferson's advantage. Napoleon sold all his North American possessions for practically nothing. The early Federalist attempts to undercut Jefferson's coup in acquiring the Louisiana Territory emphasized the impulsive character of Napoleon's decision, which had nothing to do with Jefferson's diplomatic maneuverings and everything to do with the shifting European context and the unpredictable Napoleonic character. The deeper truth was that Louisiana was a providential gift from the insurgent slaves and the malaria-carrying mosquitoes of Santo Domingo, now the Dominican Republic, and Haiti. The immediate cause of Napoleon's decision to abandon his dreams of a French empire in America was the disastrous failure of a 25,000-man expeditionary force headed by Charles Leclerc, Napoleon's brother-in-law, that had been dispatched to Santo Domingo to suppress the slave insurrection there under the charismatic leadership of a mulatto named Toussaint Louverture. Believing that a show of American support against the revolutionary government of Toussaint might win Napoleon's favor, Jefferson had informed the French government that "nothing would be easier than to furnish your army and fleet with everything and to reduce Toussaint to starvation." As it happened, Leclerc's troops were decimated in the savage fighting against the slave insurrectionaries before American aid could arrive, and the mosquitoes killed off the rest. The virtual extinction of the French expeditionary force, which had been scheduled to proceed to New Orleans after dispatching the blacks of Santo Domingo, was the immediate cause of Napoleon's decision to cut his losses in the Western Hemisphere. In that sense, Jefferson was not only extraordinarily lucky, but also beholden to historical forces that he had actually opposed. If, then, one ever wished to construct a monument in New Orleans, memorializing the Louisiana Purchase, Jefferson would have to be a central figure, but he would also need to be flanked by busts of Toussaint and his fellow black insurrectionaries, plus perhaps a tribute to the deadly mosquito. And the most appropriately eloquent quotation would come from Talleyrand, that ubiquitous and famously unscrupulous French foreign minister. "I can give you no direction," he said to Livingston. "You have made a noble bargain for yourselves, and I suppose you will make the most of it." Talleyrand was referring to the imprecise and therefore controversial borders of French Louisiana, but his statement accurately described Jefferson's presidential style in the immediate aftermath of the sale. He violated his most cherished political principles several times over in order to guarantee the most expansive version of the noble bargain, and he temporarily made himself into just the kind of monarchical chief magistrate he had warned against. "It is incumbent on those who accept great charges," he explained afterward, "to risk themselves on great occasions," adding that to lose our country by a scrupulous adherence to written laws would be to lose the law itself. With regard to the borders question, Jefferson had acted preemptively, even before knowing whether Napoleon would sell all or part of Louisiana. He commissioned his private secretary, Meriwether Lewis, to organize an expedition comprised of 10 or 12 chosen men to explore the Trans-Mississippi region and discover the most direct water route, if any existed, to the Pacific. Since France and Spain still owned the huge tract Lewis would be exploring, Jefferson obtained authorization from Congress on the pretense that this was a scientific venture or a literary pursuit, and that it would go no farther west than the Mississippi Basin. This official explanation satisfied curiosity, he informed Lewis, and masks sufficiently the real destination. News of the Louisiana Purchase arrived just as what history has come to know as the Lewis and Clark Expedition departed Washington. So from the very start, they knew themselves to be a covert reconnaissance team exploring the western borders and beyond of America's newest possession. Once Lewis was launched into the vast and unmapped interior of the Trans-Mississippi West, Jefferson turned his attention to the Gulf Coast. Back at Monticello during the late summer of 1803, he studied old maps and determined to his own satisfaction that the southeastern border of French Louisiana was the Perdido River, near present-day Pensacola. Subsequent scrutiny of the maps also satisfied him that the southwestern border was the Rio Grande. This meant that the United States had acquired all the land west of modern Florida along the Gulf Coast through present-day Texas. France had no objections to this somewhat expansive interpretation of the treaty. As Talleyrand had indicated, France was washing its hands of the entire American business, and no one in France knew the location of the Perdido or Rio Grande from the Hudson or Potomac anyway. Spain, however, took a somewhat less charitable view of the American claims, insisting that neither the Gulf Coast, called West Florida, nor any land southwest of New Orleans was included in the purchase. Jefferson instructed Monroe to leave Paris for Madrid and there make a modest effort to buy West Florida from Spain. "We scarcely expect any liberal or just settlement with Spain," Jefferson observed, "but it made little difference, since, whatever may be the views of Spain, there will be no difficulty in getting through with our purposes. In short, Spain being Spain, it should be regarded as a mere holding company for the United States. And if, as soon as she is at war, we push them strongly with one hand, holding out a price in the other, We shall certainly obtain the Floridas, and all in good time. Though it required another 15 years, plus the military adventurism of Andrew Jackson, that is exactly what happened. Finally, and most famously, there were the constitutional questions raised by the acquisition of so vast a tract, whatever the borders. Although Madison and Gallatin tried to persuade him otherwise, Jefferson remained convinced that the enlargement of the Union required an amendment to the Constitution. "The Constitution has made no provision for our holding foreign territory," he acknowledged. "The executive, in seizing the fugitive occurrence, have done an act beyond the Constitution." As Jefferson explained to Senator John Breckinridge of Kentucky, he had been placed in the awkward position of a guardian who, presented with an unprecedented investment opportunity, had decided to act without obtaining the consent of his clients, saying in effect, "I thought it my duty to risk myself for you." But he was now under moral obligation to request a constitutional amendment from the Congress at the same time he forwarded the treaty for ratification. By the time the special session of Congress convened in October 1803, however, Jefferson had changed his mind. Reports from Paris indicated that the ever-impulsive Napoleon was having second thoughts. At the same time, the Spanish were threatening to challenge the entire treaty on the ground that no one really knew the proper boundaries of Louisiana. Fearing that any delay might put the purchase at risk, Jefferson concluded that the less that is said about my constitutional difficulty, the better, and that it will be desirable for Congress to do what is necessary in silence. If the choice was between sustaining his strict interpretation of executive authority or losing half a continent, he chose the more pragmatic course, all the while expressing the hope that the good sense of our country will correct the evil of broad construction when it shall produce ill effects. The constitutional embarrassments became worse over the succeeding months. The huge Republican majority in Congress ratified the Louisiana Purchase, as one senator put it, in less time than required for the most trivial Indian contract, then passed enabling legislation that delegated to the president nearly autocratic power over decisions about a provisional government in the Louisiana Territory. John Quincy Adams, one of the few senators to oppose the legislation, observed that Jefferson would possess an assumption of implied power greater than all the assumptions of implied powers in the years of the Washington and Adams administrations put together. The old enemy of George III now wielded more arbitrary power over the residents of Louisiana than any British king had wielded over the American colonists. Moreover, Jefferson chose to use that executive power to propose a blatantly non-Republican territorial government. His outline for a proposed constitution was accompanied by a cover letter to Senator Breckinridge, swearing him to secrecy. "You must never let any person know that I have put pen to paper," he warned, "and should destroy the original," immediately after making a copy. "I am this particular," Jefferson explained, "because you know with what bloody teeth and fangs the Federalists will attack any sentiment of principle known to come from me, and what blackguardisms and personalities they make at the occasion of vomiting forth." The chief reason for Jefferson's apprehension was that the provisional government of the territory he proposed consisted of a governor appointed by the president and a non-elected council or senate, which Jefferson called the Assembly of Notables. This was precisely the kind of constitutional arrangement one might have expected from John Adams, who was more comfortable with aristocratic entrustments of authority, preferred ornate titles, and might have argued that the predominantly French residents of Louisiana would appreciate a familiar political framework reminiscent of the Ancien Régime. But this was also precisely the kind of government Jefferson had condemned the Federalists for preferring, since it deprived the residents of any elective rights and, as Madison privately admitted, "will leave the people of that district for a while without the organization of power dictated by the Republican theory." During the debate over Jefferson's proposal in the Senate, John Quincy Adams, undoubtedly enjoying the irony and fully aware the Republicans would vote whatever Jefferson wanted, attempted to add a provision protecting the rights of the Louisiana residents against being taxed without their consent. The following year, a delegation of three agents from the territory came to Washington to present a remonstrance, protesting the violation of their rights and their de facto status as colonists. "Do the political axioms on the Atlantic become problems," they asked rhetorically, "when transplanted to the shores of the Mississippi?" Jefferson avoided any contact with the delegation or conversation about their remonstrance. In his private correspondence, he explained that "our new fellow citizens in Louisiana are as yet incapable of self-government. As children, yet some cannot bring themselves to suspend Republican principles for a single moment." The suspension was only temporary, he promised, until he could be assured that the political temperature had sufficiently lowered to avoid the risk of insurrection. From the long-term historical perspective, and with all the advantages of hindsight, Jefferson's controversial decisions about the Louisiana Territory can be, most of them indeed should be, defended as wise. The decision to bypass the constitutional issue was unquestionably correct, for the practical reason that the debate over a constitutional amendment would have raised a constellation of nettlesome questions about slavery and the slave trade, Indian lands, Spanish land claims, and a host of other jurisdictional issues that might have put the entire purchase at risk. The hard-boiled and dismissive attitude toward Spanish arguments about borders, especially in West Florida, followed naturally from a realistic assessment of Spanish impotence and American demographic destiny. Even the decision to install an essentially arbitrary and despotic provisional government over the Louisiana Territory to carry it through the early years of assimilation cannot be condemned outright, since both the sheer size of the region and the ethnic diversity of the Creole population posed governance problems that justified a firmer hand at the start. The issue, then, is not whether Jefferson's policies toward Louisiana were right or wrong, but rather how he managed to implement decisions that defied in so many ways his long-standing commitment to limitations on executive power and the near-sacred character of Republican principles. Two of the more conventional answers to this question do not ring true. First, Jefferson was not simply seized by power-hungry impulses once he assumed the presidency, since in a broad range of other policy areas, he exhibited considerable discipline over the executive branch and habitual deference to the Congress. Second, he did not suddenly discover a pragmatic streak in his political philosophy, since on issues like the debt and, later on, the embargo, he clung tenaciously to Jeffersonian principles, despite massive evidence that they were at odds with reality. The pragmatic interpretation fails to explain why he was capable of putting his belief in pure republicanism aside in this instance and not in others. The answer would seem to be the special, indeed almost mystical, place the West had in his thinking. When history presented him with an unexpected and unprecedented opportunity to eliminate forever the presence on America's western border of any major European power, Spain did not count here, it triggered his most visionary energies, which then overrode his traditional republican injunctions. For Jefferson, more than any other major figure in the revolutionary generation, the West was America's future. Securing a huge swatch of it for posterity meant prolonging for several generations the systemic release of national energy that accompanied the explosive movement of settlements across the unsettled spaces. The Indians, like Spain, did not count in this calculus. What Frederick Jackson Turner later called a safety valve was for Jefferson more like a self-renewing engine that drove the American Republic forward. The West was the place where his agrarian idol would be regularly rediscovered, thereby postponing into the indefinite future the crowded conditions and political congestions of European society. Jefferson liked to think of the West in much the same way that some modern optimists think of technology, as almost endlessly renewable and boundlessly prolific. It was the secret weapon that made the American experiment in republicanism immune to the national aging process, at least for the remainder of the century. It was America's fountain of youth. As a result, any issue involving the fate of the American West possessed the potential to trump his other political convictions. Jefferson's visionary sense of what the West meant for America also made him virtually immune to the doubts, prevalent among Federalists and even shared by some of his Republican colleagues, about the country's capacity to assimilate the vast Louisiana Territory. After all, when such a massive area had come under British control after the French and Indian War in 1763, it had led directly to political problems that eventually resulted in the American Revolution and the dissolution of the British Empire in America. While Easterners, especially New England Federalists, worried that their influence would erode as more Western states entered the Union, the predominant fear was fragmentation, that the expanded version of the United States would split up into several regional units in the European mode. Jefferson's reaction to such fear was almost cavalierly dismissive. "Whether we remain in one confederacy or form into Atlantic and Mississippi confederacies, I believe not very important to the happiness of either part. Those of the Western Confederacy will be as much our children and descendants as those of the Eastern, and I feel myself as much identified with that country in future time as with this." This was a remarkable statement, since it conveyed an almost ostentatious nonchalance toward the preservation of national union, the dominant political issue of the next half century. Jefferson did not worry about the integration of the West into the United States, because he thought about the process more dynamically and as part of a larger transformation. From this perspective, the United States was not just integrating the West into the Union. The West was actually integrating the older United States into a newer and ever-changing version of America. In spirit, if not in fact, Jefferson was a Westerner, captivated by the apparently endless horizons and the exciting unknowns that Meriwether Lewis might bring back to nourish the present with news of the future. It also helped that the vast majority of Westerners were likely to prove staunch Republicans. Scandals. If the West was that future place where the creative juices of the expanding American Republic flowed most freely, then New England was the past, where, as Jefferson saw it, Federalism stewed in its own poisonous juices while adjusting to its abiding irrelevancy. Unfortunately for Jefferson, whose impressive intellectual range did not extend to an appreciation of the compressed energies of New England Puritanism, his declaration of war to the death against the incurables of Federalism alienated some of the most formidable figures among the best educated population in the country. Jefferson was an excellent hater and a skillful polemicist, but he more than met his match in the Federalist press and pulpit, where the expiring condition of Federalism as a viable political movement only intensified the desperation of its defenders. Later in life, after Jefferson and Adams had reconciled and resumed their correspondence, they kept up a running joke about which one could assemble the larger volume of vindictive criticism directed at him during his presidency. This was one area of playful competition where Jefferson was the indisputable winner. The assaults on his character were unparalleled in the history of the early republic. That does not mean they were unprecedented. During the presidential campaign of 1800, Adams had been subjected to several attempts at character assassination, the chief blow coming from Hamilton, who published a lengthy indictment of the president's explosive personality. The gist of the charge was that Adams was mentally deranged and fully capable of destroying the infant American Republic during one of his spasms of lunacy. Even the godlike Washington had become a target of abuse during his second term, when he was accused of senility as well as pro-Hamilton favoritism that derived from the groundless but sensational allegation that Hamilton was secretly his illegitimate son. Hamilton himself was charged with a variety of indiscretions, the most scandalous being that his sexual affair with a married woman exposed him to blackmail by the woman's husband, who demanded political favors for his silence. Ever the master of audacity, Hamilton took out newspaper space to announce that the charges of infidelity were sadly true, but that despite this personal failure, His public virtue as a government official had never been compromised. The line of demarcation that he attempted to draw between his private life and his public integrity was precisely the line that newspaper editors and political pundits refused to recognize. By the time Jefferson ascended to the presidency, then, the private lives of public figures were clearly regarded as fair game by the press, and Jefferson, who had been active in the 1790s, knew perfectly well that he could expect the same treatment. "They say we lied them out of power," he observed in reference to the Federalists, "and openly avow they will do the same by us." The Federalist barrage started right away, though the earliest shots tended to be aimed to wound rather than kill, poking fun at such targets as the distinctive Jeffersonian literary style, with its fondness for exalted phrasings and frequent alliterations. "Man is, by nature, a mighty megalonyx," wrote one Federalist in mock imitation of the Declaration of Independence. "Produced purposely, in a philosophical view, to prowl, pillage, propagate, and putrefy." The publication of 5 new editions of Notes on Virginia in 1801, presumably an effort by publishers to cash in on Jefferson's new visibility as president, offered Federalist editors a broad range of easy targets. For some reason, they tended to fasten upon Jefferson's claim that huge, hairy, prehistoric beasts called mammoths still lived on in the unexplored American West, one of those pre-Darwinian ideas Jefferson found attractive because it supported his anti-Buffon contention that the American environment produced large animals. Federalist wits ridiculed his mammoth theory over and over again, and the motif became a centerpiece of opposition sarcasm toward Jefferson's pretensions as a scientist. In the same quasi-playful mode, Jefferson's defenders countered the mammoth onslaught by presenting him with a mammoth cheese, weighing 1,235 pounds, reputedly from the milk of 900 cows, not one of them a Federalist. The truly serious assaults on his character first came on the religious front. In his Notes on Virginia, Jefferson had presented an argument for religious freedom that concluded with a clever comment on his own open-mindedness. "But it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no gods. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." The Federalist clergy of New England seized on the remark as conclusive evidence that Jefferson was some combination of pagan, infidel, atheist, and heretic. Editorials throughout New England played on the theme that the most Christian country in the world was now headed by a man who denied the central tenets of Christianity. While Jefferson does not appear to have been personally hurt by the charge, he recognized the political damage it was doing to his party, so he composed a brief essay on the merits of Jesus as a role model, which was actually based on a similar essay by Joseph Priestley, the English theist, that compared Jesus and Socrates as splendid embodiments of humanistic values. Jefferson saw to it that his essay was leaked to Republican friends in order to counter what he called the anti-Christian system imputed to me by those who know nothing of my opinions. Yes, he explained to Benjamin Rush, he did reject the corruptions of Christianity, but not the genuine precepts of Jesus himself. Such distinctions were wasted, of course, on his Federalist critics, who were looking for ammunition rather than the truth. Jefferson provided them with more than they could have hoped for when, only 2 weeks after his inauguration, he offered passage on a government ship to Tom Paine, who was attempting to return to America from France after barely escaping the guillotine. Jefferson's letter to Paine was picked up by the American press from the Paris papers, where Paine himself had probably planted it to publicize the honor of Jefferson's testimonial. "I am in hopes," Jefferson wrote to Paine, "you will find us returned generally to sentiments worthy of former times. In these it will be your glory to have steadily labored, and with as much effort as any man living, that you may long live to continue your useful labors and reap reward in the thankfulness of nations is my sincere prayer. Accept assurance of my high esteem and affectionate attachment." From Jefferson's perspective, Tom Paine was an authentic American hero, a charter member of the Band of Brothers that made the American Revolution happen, and had then carried the spirit of 76 to France, where it had produced more collateral damage than either man had anticipated, true enough, but where the future would surely recover the original ethos. Unfortunately for Jefferson, Paine's reputation in America had not aged well. When he landed in Baltimore, the local newspaper caught the mood by observing sarcastically that our pious president thought it expedient to dispatch a frigate for the accommodation of this loathsome reptile. Paine's chief offense was not that he was a practicing alcoholic with the social graces of a derelict, though that was true, but rather that he had written The Age of Reason, which was as full-throated an attack on Christianity as common sense had been on monarchy. By publicly associating with Paine, Jefferson exposed himself to the full broadside blast of the Federalist press as an arch-infidel, a defiler of Christian virtue, and a companion of the most vile, corrupt, obnoxious sinner of the century. All Americans who took Christianity seriously now had to make a choice, said one editor, between renouncing their savior or their president. The attacks were relentless and unequaled in the early history of the young nation for their polemical intensity. As Henry Adams put it, if Jefferson had decided to congratulate Napoleon for his despotic seizure of power in France, he could not have excited in the minds of the New England Calvinists so deep a sense of disgust by seeming to identify himself with Paine. It was, in a real sense, one of Jefferson's finer moments, since he was fully aware of Paine's notoriety, but stuck by him in the end, even inviting him to live and dine at the presidential mansion for several weeks. Federalist editors had a field day describing the two Toms walking arm in arm, allegedly comparing notes on the ideal way to promote atheism or their past successes in despoiling Christian virgins. The circle of our president's felicities is greatly enlarged, observed the editor of the Federalist Portfolio, by the indulgence of Sally the Sable and the auspicious arrival of Tom Paine the Pious. The reference to Sally the Sable was a casual insertion of the most sensational accusation made against Jefferson, a charge of sexual and, in its own day, racial impropriety that became the equivalent of a tin can tied to Jefferson's reputation that has continued to rattle through the ages and the pages of the history books. Virtually every Federalist newspaper in the country picked up the story, which first appeared in the Richmond Recorder in September 1802. "It is well known," the story began, "that the man, whom it delighteth the people to honor, keeps, and for many years past has kept, as his concubine, one of his own slaves. Her name is Sally. The name of her eldest son is Tom. His features are said to bear a striking, although sable, resemblance to those of the president himself." For several months, the Federalist press printed editorials disclaiming knowledge as to whether the allegations were true, but then proceeding to provide readers with colorful variations on the provocative gossip, some even set to verse. "Of all the damsels on the green, on mountain or in valley, alas, so luscious ne'er was seen as Monticellian Sally." Editorials referred to Dusky Sally, Black Sal, the African Venus, and the Mahogany-Colored Charmer. The Boston press was especially interested in how the 59-year-old president managed to make love with a much younger, Sally was 31 or 32, woman. The answer was her African features. "Thick, pouting lips, how sweet their grace, when passion fires to kiss them. Wide spreading over half the face, impossible to miss them." And so on. It was a publicist's dream at the time because it gave the Federalists, who were growing more desperate with each Republican victory in the ongoing state elections, the kind of small but sharp-edged piece of scandal that cut across all party or policy disagreements and straight into the core question of Jefferson's character. It has been a publicist's dream ever since, because the charges cannot be conclusively proved or disproved, and because advocates on each side of the debate have just enough evidence at their disposal to block a comfortable verdict for the opposition. John Adams had one of the shrewdest reactions to the charges when they first surfaced. Adams was still in his anti-Jefferson phase, so his response was not conditioned by their former friendship. As a victim of similarly venomous vendettas, Adams claimed to empathize with Jefferson. On the other hand, the allegations were a natural and almost inevitable consequence of a foul contagion in the human character, Negro slavery. Jefferson was not only contaminated by that contagion, but also not above suspicion because there was not a planter in Virginia, Adams observed, who could not reckon among his slaves a number of his children. The charge of sexual impropriety therefore placed a blot on his character that was not completely implausible. Even if not factually true, it possessed a certain moral truth because it raised to relief the inherently immoral condition in which all slave owners, Jefferson included, lived their lives. What Adams did not say for the record, but almost surely thought, was that there was an analogous sense of poetic justice about the allegations, regardless of their accuracy, because they originated with a former Republican scandalmonger named James Callender, whose previous career had been spent vilifying Jefferson's opponents, Adams among them, in much the same truth-be-damned fashion, and with Jefferson's support and approval. Callender had been the reporter to break the story of Hamilton's shady escapades in 1797, and the following year had slandered Adams as the corrupt and despotic monarch of Braintree in a pamphlet entitled The Prospect Before Us. Jefferson had endorsed and helped pay for Prospect, but Callender, whose only consistency was a perverse flair for treachery, turned against him when Jefferson refused to reward his labors with the postmaster's job in Richmond. According to one Federalist account, probably apocryphal, Callender lingered outside the presidential mansion for several days, hoping for a personal interview. When he spotted Jefferson at an upstairs window, he shouted out his threat. "Sir, you know that by lying I made you president, and I'll be damned if I do not unmake you by telling the truth." Jefferson denounced Callender as a lying renegade from republicanism, then had Monroe, still governor of Virginia at the time, release statements denying that Jefferson had ever befriended or salaried Callender or had anything to do with his earlier diatribes against Adams. But Callender had saved his copies of Jefferson's incriminating letters and immediately distributed them to the Federalist press. "I thank you for the proof sheets you enclosed me," Jefferson had written to Callender in reference to Prospect. "Such papers cannot fail to produce the best effect." Although a long-term sexual relationship with one of his slaves was not in character for Jefferson, who spent much of his adult life creating distances between his personal perceptions and the palpable reality of slavery, and who consistently fled from intimacy in favor of highly idealized and sentimentalized versions of affection, the duplicity that was exposed in his dealings with Callender was wholly in character. It was the Freneau deception and the Mazzei mischief all over again, with Jefferson denying to himself and then to the world his complicity in behind-the-scenes political skullduggery, then being genuinely surprised when the truth came out. Now, with the publication of his ill-considered correspondence with Callender, he was caught in a lie, which was bad enough, but the lie also enhanced the credibility of Callender's other charges about more titillating behind-the-scenes escapades with Sally Hemings. Again, the accusations of sexual promiscuity defy most of the established patterns of Jefferson's emotional life, not because, as his latter-day defenders would have it, Jefferson was too honorable a Virginian gentleman to engage in such behavior, but because his deepest urges were more self-protective and sentimental than sexual. He was eminently vulnerable to the charges, however, for all the reasons Adams identified, and because it was difficult for an outside observer to distinguish between one kind of sinful secret and another. While the scar on Jefferson's reputation never went away, and the New England Federalists did their best to keep the accusations alive in the public press, even going so far as to put the matter of Jefferson's character on the official agenda of the Massachusetts legislature, the political damage to his presidency proved less serious than the lingering stigma that attached itself to his image with posterity. The damage control teams in the Republican press helped the cause. Jefferson's posture of total silence on the matter prevented any prolonged debate from feeding on itself, and, most significant, the steady string of Republican successes. The debt was being retired, tax